Thank you for the introduction. So this is the story I'll tell you today. It's been going on for a little while, and it's based on work published and unpublished with my former student, Olof Engelund, with Sergei Frolov, Ben Hoare, Oleg Lunin, and Arkady Tsaitlin. And it has to do with strings in these kind of spaces, and in particular, what can we do to these things such that they don't look like what we started with. So perhaps the best studied example of gauge string duality remains, to the date, the relation between n equals 4 superangles and strings in ABS 5 process 5. And an integral part of this remains integrability, both from a two-dimensional point of view, as well as, in some sense, from a four-dimensional point of view. It's fair to say that even though it's been used extensively, there is no real proof of integrability to all orders in any perturbation theory, weak coupling or strong coupling, even though there is evidence of finite coupling that it should exist. Now, assuming that it exists, there's been lots and lots of efforts to understand its consequences, and the consequences are great. We can write equations whose solutions give us anomalous dimensions of gauge invariant operators or energies of string states to, at least in principle, any order in perturbation theory, again, weak or strong coupling. It's been used as a crutch for perturbative evaluation of three-point functions. It would be great to push it beyond the crutch level, but all the same, it's great to have it. It led to new approaches to computing perturbative, computing planar scattering amplitudes in n equals 4 superangles. Its power in this context is that it resums the expansion in the coupling constant, but it provides another expansion parameter, which is some kind of energy type, which lets one do another expansion for regular scattering amplitudes, and again, something that resums usual perturbation theory. Now, as you guys know a lot better than me, this has been extended to other context in which ABS 5 process 5 is replaced by something else. And typically this goes by finding a supergravity solution and then wondering what are its properties. Perhaps a supergravity solution with a good idea in mind, like we want to describe this particular gauge theory or that particular gauge theory. But one could at least in principle turn this around and say, well, gee, there are really, really many sigma models that one can use as string worksheets. The questions are, from this perspective, what are the physically interesting ones, which are the ones that have something to do with a gauge theory, if there is a gauge string duality for that particular worksheet, and which ones are integrable, and which ones can actually be solved, even if we know that they are integrable. And to this, in this direction, there is a formal approach. You start with something that you know is good from by your definition of good, and then you deform it somehow. And well, this is good because if the deformation preserves integrability, one can hope that something is computable, perhaps exactly. One finds this way perhaps new non-trivial CFTs with more or less supersymmetry from a target space perspective. One finds new integrable models, which typically are hard to find. Anyway, it's typically a win-win situation. Now, for strings in ADS5 process 5, the set of integrable deformations that has been known was limited, and it's basically here. They are orbifolds and something called gamma deformations, which corresponds to extensions of the of one of the usual Lee Strassler deformations of n equals 4 superangles. And these guys turn out to be relatively easy to deal with, mainly because they have something to do with worksheets with, again, in ABS 5 process 5, just with a little bit peculiar boundary conditions. That's all there is to it. So the question is there anything more? And turns out that there is. And these guys came up with something. This is the eta deformation, which I'll be talking about. So its construction makes use of a solution of a classical Young-Baxter equation, which has really little or nothing to do with the classical Young-Baxter equation of strings in ABS. It generalizes constructions which have been pioneered by Klimchik some 10, 15 years ago. The superconformal, four-dimensional superconformal group is completely broken, but not that much, really. It's actually replaced. It's replaced with its quantum deformed version. So this is a space-time that has a quantum symmetry. The geometry exhibits, perhaps unpleasantly, naked singularities, which are really extended. And I'll show you how they look. It's not exactly clear what its dual field theory is, mainly because of this.
Is it completely broken? Does the quantum, does the Q change the ADS part or just the S?
It changes everything.
Everything.
So the gauge theory, if it exists at all, it is something that's not Lorentz invariant, uh-huh. and it's something that's actually not conformal. And I will show you something a little bit, rather peculiar about it. In particular, one of them is written here, it's UV. Because of this naked singularity, it's UV. It's either ill-defined or it's chopped off in some sense. Okay, so now I will attempt to describe why these are true briefly. But assuming for the second that they are true, there are a bunch of questions that one would perhaps be interested to answer. Like, how terrible is this naked singularity? Should we just throw away this thing, or should we treat it as a nice sigma model, which happens to be integrable, incidentally, and perhaps try to deal with it somehow? Is there a complete supergravity background which actually turns this into something useful, again, from a low-energy point of view? Does integrability survive quantum mechanically? Does the quantum symmetry survive quantum mechanically? What is the worksheet S matrix? What can you do with it, et cetera, et cetera? So these are questions some of these are questions that I will attempt to address, and none of them will receive a 100% satisfactory answer. At least not today. But anyway, we have to start somewhere. So this is the plan. I will describe a little bit the eta deformation from a worksheet perspective. We will probe a little bit the singularity. Rather than sending particles to them, we'll try to poke them with a stick. See what happens. See if we can poke them with a stick, actually. And then we'll try for a little while to construct a supergravity background. For this, we will not talk about ADS5. We'll talk about lower dimensional versions, and there will be something to say about it. And then, if I speak sufficiently fast, we'll get to the worksheet S matrix and see what happens to integrability and the quantum symmetry at quantum level. If I don't get there, they both survive. So there's nothing to worry about. Okay, so what is the eta deformation and what can we say about it quickly from the string worksheet? So whatever I'll say really applies to all spaces of this type, which are all cosets of this type, with the numerator one of these guys, and the denominator H being the fixed point of an automorphism that acts roughly like this. So M, this is the super transpose, it's the regular transpose, just tossing some signs in front of the fermions. And K is a matrix that's made out of, in this case, it's made out of a bunch of sigma 3s, which are placed on the diagonal. Its form doesn't really matter. What does matter is that this is a Z4, and as a consequence, it breaks up the left invariant 1 forms into 4 pieces with eigenvalues 0, I to the 0, I to the 1, I to the 2, I to the 3. And out of these guys, the undeformed action can be constructed quickly. It's just bilinear. And the fact that the Vesumino term is bilinear is a special feature of cosets of this type. And this can be written in this way at the expense of introducing some notation. These p's are projectors onto various eigenvalues. And the reason to introduce this is that with these guys introduced, it's a little bit easier to define what the eta deformation does. When it's two ingredients, one is a new version of this combination, which looks like this. And this is the eta. And then when it's a peculiar operator called R index G, which acts as follows. It conjugates the matrix it acts on by G. Then it does something to it. And I'll tell you what it does. And then it conjugates it back. So the resulting action will depend on the left invariant 1 form and G, unlike the original action, which depends just on the projector. So this R, this operator R, is a solution of this equation. If there were zero here, this is a classically Young-Baxter equation. With this known zero, it's something slightly different. Okay, so this is not something anyone would have thought about immediately. So these guys came up with it because they first looked at the SU2 sigma model and then generalized it from there. And the action. The action is this. Okay, so there's an eta missing here. So there's this inverse that one needs to compute and then act on this with this D and then take the supertrace. It's roughly the same as that, as this, except with some dressing. Okay, so what is R? There are several R's that one can pick. There are several solutions to this equation, but one that's quite popular looks like this. And in words, what it does is it takes the generators corresponding to the positive roots of the group G. It tosses a minus I in front of them, takes the negative roots, tosses an I in front of them, and then kills all the Cartan generators. So that's what this thing does. It takes whatever it acts here, and then it does that. So to extract the action is a little bit of a pain. One way to do it is be cavalier, pick a representative, and transform everything to the adjoint representation. Construct this matrix, which is the representation of the denominator of this inverse. Invert it, and then looks like this. It's more or less, in this form, it looks more or less like a standard sigma model, except that the group invariant metric, which would be G, is replaced by this odd-looking combination.
Sorry, did you say what D is, D sub eta?
Yeah, D is this thing. So these P's are projectors onto these guys, and the projector onto the bosonic part is dressed with this eta.
Is there some sense in which some symmetry chooses that as the only action you can write? Or are you just choosing something that's nice for some other reason?
These guys know best. They wrote a PRL about it, and they said this is the action, and it has these properties. They didn't exactly justify why they picked this one. My guess is that this is one of the few integrable deformations that has a closed form expression.
And so I guess, so this is a naive question, but the fact that it's integrable means that a fortiori it's renormalizable as a 2D model?
So this is still, from a two-dimensional perspective, this is still supposed to be a conformal field theory. So it should, in fact, be finite. And if we get to the S matrix, it will be fine. The fact that it's integrable means that it has an infinite number of conserved quantities, which, either local or non-local, depending how you choose to look at them. And this particular one does. It does have a Lac connection, which is in some sense inherited from the Lax connection of ADS5 process 5, but in a rather peculiar way because of all this action. But this one does have this Lax connection. More questions? All right. So this action does have, as they showed, it has PSU 2,2, well, G index Q quantum symmetry, where the Q parameter is this. Now, so here is the coupling constant, otherwise known as square root of lambda, from n equals 4 point of view. So one could imagine that at quantum level, this Q gets deformed, something gets further renormalized, or whatever. It's, again, classically integrable. And one can, of course, ask the question if this action, as it stands, it's still a good Green-Schwarz-type action. Perhaps this thing does something to the quadratic term in fermions, and it's no longer reducible. Well, the action does happen to have a kappa symmetry, but it's of a peculiar kind. It usually, a kappa transformation lies entirely in the fermionic directions. This one doesn't. Nevertheless, it still seems to be infinitely reducible, and one can check on a case-by-case basis that half of the fermions get projected out. So based on this, one can hope that this is a standard action, standard Green-Schwarz type action, perhaps up to some field redefinitions to put it in the standard form, but nevertheless. So now, out of this one, can extract the geometry in the usual way, throw away the fermions and focus on the bosons and try to put them in the standard form with the metric and the B field. And this is what comes out. Five-dimensional version was done by these guys some year and a little ago. The metric, so out of this one can extract a metric and the B field. And this is what used to be ADS. This is what used to be the sphere. So here I've highlighted the bad terms. This is the coefficient of dt square, and it's singular at rho equals 1 over kappa. And this is the coefficient of d rho square, and it's also singular. And this is where that naked singularity sits. There is nothing that terrible happening on the sphere, but all the same, this is bad enough. There is a little manifest symmetry here. And this is just abelian, u1 to the 6. There's a curvature singularity here, the one that I was just mentioning. And because of this problem here, the boundary is no longer connected to the center of ADS. There is a signature flip that happens at rho equals kappa inverse. So if one sits in the middle, one should better sit in the middle and not attempt to go out and vice versa. One can also see what, to get some indication what happens to the UV of the dual gauge theory, if there is one, one could go to the Poincaré patch, and then there also the boundary is removed completely. So from this perspective, the UV of the dual field theory is either unreachable in some sense, or it's ill-defined in some sense, which I can't describe. Yes?
Can you say again how you got that metric?
This metric? Right, so they picked a particularly nice representative of this coset. Then they constructed these matrices. Basically, they found D and this R and this things. And then they constructed this omega, inverted it, and then they fished out the part that's symmetric in dx dx, and they called it metric, and the part that's anti-symmetric in dx dx, and they called it B. It's a little bit of a non-trivial exercise to actually pick the right representative to get something manageable, but
So the fact that the sigma model is integrable, I mean, does that mean that strings propagating on this background are well-defined even with the naked singularity?
We're getting there. I don't know exactly what happens to a small string, but I'm going to tell you what happens to if you try to take this singularity and poke a stick at it. The short answer is you can't reach it.
You can't reach
it. You can't reach it no matter how hard you push.
So strings stay away from it in some sense.
Ideally, yes. I wish I knew exactly what happens to a short string. So just something that you throw at it and see what happens. But and this should be a solvable problem just because of integrability, but I don't know the answer to it yet. Okay.
Can we extend it to, so those denominators change sign. Yeah. Now, can we think about the region outside those denominators, outside that radius, and have T and rho change? No, I guess T and rho couldn't change. Well, I guess it would be very different.
Outside, T rho becomes time-like and T becomes space-like.
Okay, right. So it would be non-static, but okay, good.
Okay. One can repeat all of this in lower dimensions, and in those cases, the B field goes away completely, and one just gets metrics, which are nice-ish. Except for the same problem, ADS2 is particularly simple. Just because it's two-dimensional. Here I didn't write for you the curvature because it's long and unilluminating. Here it's shorter and unilluminating. What happens? Oh yeah, a little bit later we'll try to take these guys and extend them to, you know, add to them some dilaton and some forms to turn them into supergravity solutions. But before that, let's try to poke the singularity and see what happens. So again, as you were suggesting, one can throw a particle at it and see what happens. For reasons which I won't go into, we prefers to look at a folded string just because it gives two pieces of information at once, what happens at the singularity, and also something about the dual mixture. So this is what I'm going to tell you. The idea is you take a string and you spin it in ADS, and if eta were zero, if you spin it hard enough, the fold points touch the boundary. So naively, one would think that if you were to cut the space somewhere, then if you spin it hard enough, you will eventually touch the singularity and see what happens. So this is how the solution looks like for eta equals zero. And rho is some combination of elliptic integrals, which is not particularly illuminating. For eta non-zero, the same ansatz works, and it has roughly the same properties. I'll tell you a little bit about it. To solve the equations, it's of course profitable to start with the Virasoro condition rather than the second order equations of motion. So these are the Virasoro conditions. So the right-hand side should behave as follows. At rho equals zero, which is the center of ADS, turns out to be positive, because otherwise the string would not be here. So if this is positive, then the right-hand side should be positive for a while. Then it should go to zero, at which point is the fold point of the string. After that, it should be negative for a while, just because the string isn't there anymore. And after that, it can do whatever. Requiring that there is some positivity on this side, at least for a while around zero, constrains the parameters of the ansatz. And then the fold points end up being here. And the fact that they exist at all, meaning that the argument of the square root is positive, enforces some more constraints on the parameters. And then, as it turns out, from here, one can get information about what happens to the fold point vis-a-vis the singularity. So if you evaluate the right-hand side of this at the singular point, at 1 over kappa, it turns out to be positive. And it's positive for all values of rho which are larger than this. This implies, according to the little discussion before, this implies that the fold point should, in fact, be below rho equals rho star, because there should be a negative region, or at least a zero somewhere. Now, as it turns out, the right-hand side of this is always positive for all rho larger than at least a half rho star. So no matter how we slice this, this rho not plus minus, where the string folds on itself and turns back, is way below rho star, at least by a factor of a half. And that's no matter how much energy you end up putting into this string. It's infinite of it, and it still doesn't go past rho equals a half or so. So the short answer is the string doesn't really want to probe the singularity. It wants to stay away from it. So ideally, this would be a mechanism that works also for short strings, in the sense that if you try to throw something at it, it bounces off before reaching the singular region.
If you just look at GD6, is the timeline GD6ly complete?
We didn't look at it.
Oh.
I don't know.
But it's clearly not null genetically complete, right? That there's a F and G just have a pole in the denominator, which is the same thing, so the conformal metric doesn't show anything funny in the rho T plane. So is it right? Like, did this very
quickly.
So I think null genes is clearly reaching. You might wonder if there's a difference between the behavior of massive and massless short strings.
Ravi showed me this before, and it reminded me of the interior of a Reisler-Nordström black hole, the part where you're surrounded by a singularity. Mm-hmm. And you're also repelled from the singularity if you're in time-like QD6.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. Not sure if surrounded is a word I've used, but.
Yeah.
No?
This singularity is for all values of, for all coordinates of fixed rho, so it is really a.
In this case, you're
missing something, but with Reisler-Nordström, it's a point-like singularity, it's higher than zero. It can be kind of outside you in the conformal diagram, but it's still a zero size sphere.
Well, the size doesn't matter.
I'm not sure
you're surrounded or not. No, maybe I'm misunderstanding.
No, I'm not trying to use the word surrounded. It's a matter of semantics.
Okay.
Okay.
Yeah. Okay. Yeah, it's kind of like that.
Since we didn't look at geodesics, I can't tell you what happens. But I can tell you what happens if we assume that there is a gauge theory and that the energy of this string has something to do with the dimension of operators there in that theory. So we need to compute the energy as a function of spin and angular momentum. This is the parametric form of that relation. This would be the energy in terms of parameters, the spin, the angular momentum, and the condition that the string is actually periodic. And one can crank through this and expand at large spin, which in which case we know generic behavior of, say, gauge theory dimensions with the spin. It goes like this. The energy would be, you have a term proportional to the spin, and energy minus the spin, which would be the twist, grows like the log of the spin, and then it has corrections to this. Well, what happens here, oh yeah, and then the term in the energy proportional to the spin is linear in the spin. It's just E minus S equals log S plus. Well, Kaspar normal is dimension log S plus more. Well, as it turns out, this is what you get if you crank through the calculation. This curly L is linear in the spin with a slope which is something. It's this combination of W and of kappa. And then, so energy has a term linear in the spin, but with slope which is not 1. And then it has some constant terms, and then it has only exponential corrections. So in other words, log S is absent. So either this is a gauge theory for which the Kaspar normalized dimension is exactly 0. It seems hard to conceive, but all the same. Or it is really a strange gauge theory for which the Kaspar normalized dimension does not have, well, it looks different than, for which there is no relation between the Kaspar normalized dimension and the infinite spin limit of dimensions of twisted operators. Anyway, so no matter how you slice this, this is a quite an unusual gauge theory. Okay. Good. So now this is all I had to say about one sheet for now.
Since the theory is not conformal anymore, what do you mean by dimension?
That was on my last slide. Is a question. What exactly do we mean by that? Now, so of course there is an issue with the dimension. One can define the dimension. Well, really, one can define just the first term in the dimension. And in that, even in that case, for twist two operators at large spin, one still sees the log S. One can set all the rest to zero or to whatever one wants, but it seems, since an expansion in the coupling, it seems difficult to just set to zero that coefficient.
But for now, this is the global energy. I mean, so it's,
yes, this is the global energy.
Yeah.
So somehow this, again, this still assumes that despite the quantum deformation, there is still a relation between the global, well, the formally global ADS energy and the dimension of operators. Whether that survives, it's part of a dictionary which may or may not survive. Okay. So now we have a metric and in 10 dimensions also a B field. And we would like to construct ultimately some fields that promote it to a supergravity solution, perhaps. And now, nominally, if one is given a piece of a solution, one is not guaranteed that, first, the solution exists at all, and second, if it exists, it may not be unique. So given that we have a specific sigma model that we care about, in principle, one that we actually have a hard time actually expanding and seeing in detail, but all the same, we have a specific sigma model that we want to match, we would like to pick from whatever multitude of solutions we might get, the one that's relevant for this. And well, comparing directly with the sigma model may not be easy, but perhaps limits are easier to compute, are easier to compare. So let's first look at limits. Not necessarily physical limits, but nevertheless limits that can be analyzed from a sigma model point of view. So there are two such limits. In fact, there are three such limits. Two of them look the same, but they aren't. So one can take the deformation parameter to infinity, which is to some extent physical, and one can take the deformation parameter to I. Now, the deformation parameter was assumed real, so this, of course, assumes an analytic continuation. But if one is given an action, one could attempt to make the parameters imaginary and see what happens. Of course, unitarity may be lost in the process, but again. So this is what happens for one of these limits, one of the coupled infinity limits. So one can take the limit while at the same time rescaling the metric and also some of the coordinates and inverting some of the coordinates. And it turns out to be useful to do a couple of p-dualities along the rescaled angles. And at the end of the day, one ends up with this, which are recognizable metrics. The sitter 5, five-dimensional hyperbolic space. So in this particular limit of the anti-deformed geometry one ends up with the sitter space. Of course, there was a t-duality in here. So one can, of course, complete this in a natural way to a supergravity solution by adding an imaginary flux. One can undo this and end up with an imaginary, end up with an imaginary flux. So somehow this limit turns out not to be particularly physical because of this flux. The second limit, which is somewhat more physical, again involves scaling the metric and scaling other coordinates. And at the end of the day, this is what one ends up with. This is supported by a real five-form flux, but it also has a non-trivial dilaton, and the NS flux also goes away, just like it goes there. Now, the other, the third limit, ends up, leads to a sigma model, which is also, which appeared in a different context, as it turns out. So this eta equals I limit, kappa equals I limit, can be taken in two different ways. One can at least temporarily ignore the coefficient of the action. So one can just take the limit eta equals I at the level of the metric, and then what happens is that basically two coordinates decouple, and they become just then the rest is some curved space. Or one can take this coefficient into account, which basically amounts to rescaling the metric by zero. And then one ends up with a slightly more complicated space, which is a plane wave, well, a PP wave rather, with a non-trivial curved transverse space. And in five dimensions, this is what one ends up with. These are some sines and some sinches, and these are the transverse spaces. The kappa equals I limit leads to an imaginary B, which of course leads to a non-unitarity from the perspective of the worksheet, from the point of view of the worksheet. But if one decides to ignore that non-unitarity and basically toss away the B altogether, one finds an S matrix. Well, one finds a sigma model whose S matrix is has been encountered before. It turns out to be the S matrix of the Pohlmeier reduced strings in ADS 5 plus S 5. So Pohlmeier reduction is basically a non-local change of variables at the level of the action in which currents end up treated as fundamental variables. And this can be done for strings in ADS and pretty much all other cosets. And it leads to a theory that's different from the original one, though it's equivalent to the classical level. It's quantum mechanically different, but equivalent to the classical level. For ADS 5, it's not clear still how to complete this to a full solution. But if one goes to lower dimensions, like ADS 3 or ADS 2, things become a lot simpler. And this is what happens for ADS 3. This is the kappa equals I limit of the metric. The B field goes away because of three dimensions. And one can complete this to a solution using the dilaton and using a dilaton and a null two form. Now, why is this the right completion? Well, it's because if you take this and construct the Green-Schwarz action and fix electron gauge and massage the fermions a little bit and compare with what you get for the coset, you get the same thing. Yeah.
I'm a little puzzled why you need to complete it to get a solution. I mean, you start with a sigma model, which should have conformal invariance because you've done a deformation which preserves that. And so doesn't that mean by definition, that the fields you read off from the sigma model solve the supergravity equations?
Yes, it certainly does. So the only problem is that they can't be read off. So to read off the fields, one needs to put the action in a specific form. Right? So the bosonic one, it's g mu nu dx mu dx mu. For the Ramon fields and the Dilaton, one needs to massage the fermions in a specific form, in this form. And that is a non-trivial enterprise. In principle, if you have a set of fields that you expect to be right, then one, you can go back and construct the action that way. When you know what you want to get, you're going to get it in some way.
Oh, I see. Otherwise, you take the bosonic fields, or some of them, and you have to guess what the others are.
That's right.
When kappa equals I, why isn't the metric complex, for example?
Because it so happens that it depends only on kappa square.
Oh, okay.
So the metric depends only on kappa square. The B field is linear in kappa. Somewhere in here. Yeah, it's a bad idea. So everything depends on kappa square, but the B field is proportional to kappa.
So it gets rid of the naked singularity. If you said kappa equals one.
Yeah, that does. But somehow it.
So it comes back.
It moves it on the sphere.
Okay.
This is the ADS3 case. So if at some point we will end up with finding a solution, it should match this in the limit kappa equals I with this particular Ramon field. This can all be repeated for ADS2. In that case, the Dilaton ends up being trivial, and there's a Maxwell field that takes this specific form. which supports the solution. Okay. And again, here, in both ADS3 and ADS2 cases, one can construct the Green-Schwarz model, compare it with the Coset, and again, compare it also with the Pollmeyer reduced string theory in these ADS3 and ADS2 cases, and they all work out just as in ADS5, at least the comparison here. Okay. Now, back to the general problem of finding the solution in the presence of a generic eta. So since we know relatively little even about the limits of ADS5, I'm going to focus on ADS2 and ADS3. So these are the equations that one needs to solve for four-dimensional, and six-dimensional supergravity. There is an assumption that I put in here. Namely, that there is only one Maxwell field or only one three-form flux that supports the solution, apart from a Dilaton and a C field and an axion. And as it will turn out, this is in fact not an accurate assumption. But we'll get there. So the problem that needs to be solved is we know the metric, therefore we know R. We can, at least in principle, solve these equations and find the scalars, as well as the trace of Einstein's equations, and find the scalars. And then given this, the question is, when can we find either a Maxwell field or a three-form that supports that solution, that set of scalars and the metric? And in four dimensions, that answer was given some time ago by Mr. Reinich as Don and... Well, told me.
Will told me.
The idea is, this is a slight modification of what Mr. Reinich said, but never mind that. So the idea is we are given some combination of fields, and they define a two-index symmetric tensor, if both indices are down. A two-index symmetric tensor, and that two-index symmetric tensor, which is traceless, needs to be the stress tensor of some field, in this case, middle-dimensional field. And in four dimensions, Mr. Reinich listed two such conditions, tracelessness and the square of this matrix, this tensor T, should be proportional to the identity matrix. This can be rephrased a little bit. One can just say that it's traceless and its cube is also traceless. And to see this one, just take a Maxwell field, put it in block diagonal form, and compute the two sides, and it just is. To see the tracelessness of T cube, one needs to look at the characteristic equation of a 4x4 matrix and use this, and this one drops out. So these conditions can be generalized to basically to arbitrary even dimensions, and they look like that. Not entirely surprising, really. The trace of all odd powers of T should be zero.
These are sufficient conditions?
They are necessary, they are not sufficient. So basically, this takes into account the properties of the stress tensor of the Phuon field. Perhaps there are other things, but certainly if these are not satisfied, there is no way to find a Phuon. In six dimensions, there's an analog of this, which is slightly more complicated. It's some combination of, it's a six-order equation in T with coefficients given by the traces and some determinants. And but this is, again, to see this one, just looks at the characteristic equation and use this, and that just comes out. Okay, so with this in hand, we can attempt to solve equations for scalars and then pick whatever we want and then check if we can attempt to complete that. And in ADS2, process 2, it's, in retrospect, it's easy to construct the solution for the scalar equations for dilaton and the axion. We solve the three independent scalar equations, the dilaton, the axion, and the trace of Einstein's equation. And this solution depends on one parameter A. And it's good to have three parameters because adjusting things, well, being able to adjust things down the road is always good. It turns out that the trace conditions for this T cube is satisfied for a generic value of A. So we can attempt to construct a Maxwell field. And the solution is this one. It's relatively simple. But then we are left with one question to answer. We have a coset, and the coset depends on kappa. It doesn't depend on kappa and A. So what A? What's A? So here is where the limits come in. The limit kappa to infinity, this is what happens to the dilaton. There's a non-trivial denominator. And this is what we expect, which happens to be the numerator of this ratio. So one can set the denominator to zero by choosing A equals zero. Question, A equals zero is simple enough. So now let's look at kappa equals I. Well, kappa equals I doesn't really like A equals 0. Kappa equals I likes very much A equals 1, both the trivial limit in which the metric is not rescaled and the other one, the one that leads to a plane wave, both like kappa equals I. Sorry, both like A equals 1. So the only conclusion is A is not a number. A is a function of kappa. What function? That's a good question. So this is where a little bit of guesswork turns out to be useful. And so the coset action depends on kappa and eta in this particular combination, via D. So one could squint a little bit and pull out one of these guys and say that really kappa and eta will appear only as a ratio. And therefore, A, since it is to describe the coset, should be a function of the ratio. And then it's still a wide class of functions. But there is a very simple function that satisfies the two limits that we looked at, and that's just the identity function, A equals eta over kappa. Whether this is the right function or not, I'm not going to bet my life on it. I'm not going to bet anybody's life on it. It's a simple one, and it satisfies all limits, so maybe it is the right one. Unfortunately, to compare this with the actual coset turns out to be unpleasantly complicated. So for the time being, this value of A remains a conjecture. Perhaps a motivated one, but it's still a conjecture. Nevertheless, this is, whether you like this conjecture or not, this is an interesting class of solutions to look at just because it's weird, right? It's has a factorized metric, but it has a non-factorized dilaton, axion, and Maxwell. So this is not a factorized solution. Okay. So this is that. Now we can proceed a little bit to ADS3, where things are a lot less satisfying, as it turns out. We can follow exactly the same strategy and construct a one-parameter family of solutions to the three scalar equations. And if one analyzes the limits of the dilaton, one finds again that A should be a function of exactly the same ratio, and it should have exactly the same limits at kappa equals infinity and kappa equals I, namely 0 and 1. However, disaster strikes when one tries to go further, or maybe not disaster, but if one requires that the trace of t cubed, this t, and the trace of t to the fifth are 0, then one finds only two values of A for which this is satisfied, namely A equals 0 and A equals 1, exactly those that appear in these limits. So the moral of the story is that with a single three-form field, it's not possible to extend this field configuration to a solution of supergravity equations of motion. It may be possible to support it with two three-form fields, and at least preliminary considerations don't show any particular problems, apart from the fact that the expansions don't seem to close, at least not in a nice way. There is no closed form expression that I can show you. But it doesn't, at least we haven't encountered any particular inconsistencies. Now, I should say that two three forms, it's still consistent with the coset. If you think of basically the string construction and how you construct Ramon-Ramon forms in six dimensions versus 10 dimensions, one is allowed to have two three forms in six dimensions, at least with the amount of fermions that we have in this in the coset. So this is still okay as far as the coset is concerned. It would make it a lot more complicated to read off the two three forms from the coset if one were to look at it. But okay, so since we found that only A equals 0 and A equals 1 are consistent, well, can be completed, these are the solutions just in case. And just like in just like in the case of ADS2 crosses 2, the metric is factorized, the dilaton is not, and neither is the two-form potential. Okay, so I spoke really slowly. but not slow enough. So here are a couple of comments that I would like to make before we go on. So I said already that the solution is not factorized. It also appeared earlier that it would be interesting to have a look at the singularity with smaller probes, some that are not anchored to the center of ADS, but some that want to, that you can shoot at the singular region and see what happens. Now, there is an interesting thing that you've noticed and I didn't say, which is that if you allow yourself to do a time-like t-duality, then the result is a metric that has a regular horizon.
Sorry, I just realized that I'm confused. When you talk about ADS2 cross S2 or ADS3 cross S3, are you thinking of these as sort of part of the solution and then there's another?
Yes.
There's right. Always another X.
There's always another X, which was in the title and never appeared since.
Okay.
Yeah, so typically I'm thinking of X as being a torus, but it doesn't right. Need to be a torus. Yes. Right, so there's a thing that you may have noticed and I didn't say it. Namely, if you allow yourself to do a time-like t-duality, then the coefficient of the dt square and the coefficient of the d rho square, one goes to 0, one goes to infinity. Previously, they were going to 0 and infinity simultaneously. So now one ends up with a solution with a regular horizon at in the place where the singularity used to be. Does this mean anything? Time-like t-duality is typically a bad thing because it turns fluxes into good fluxes into imaginary fluxes and vice versa. Still, the fact that the singularity disappears, or at least that there is a normal horizon, might suggest some kind of regularity which is yet to be found. another comment is that if you look at all the dilatons that I've listed, they all blow up near the singularity. So supergravity is not really a good description of the physics there. from a type 2B point of view, one would imagine doing an S duality transformation, case in which the dilaton goes to zero there, and everything would be good, at least from this point of view. Things would be bad from a worldship, though. One loses the super coset interpretation of the worldship because S duality breaks that. One also most likely loses integrability because S duality also breaks that. Now, another thing is that one can analyze the behavior of the dilaton near the singularity, and it always goes like this. So if one tries to move from a string frame, which is what I've been discussing, to Einstein frame, the singularity is still there no matter how you slice it. And then there is, of course, the last but not least question, is it possible that the singularity simply disappears or it's moved elsewhere if one were to somehow include alpha prime corrections to the geometry in a way which I don't really know how to do, but perhaps it's possible. Okay. So this is all I have to say about supergravity solutions, and in the remaining 9 minutes, I have 55 more slides to go.
Just kidding.
So in the remaining few minutes, I wanted to tell you something about what happens to the quantum symmetry and integrability. Okay, so there are at least two ways to answer this question. One is construct the symmetry generators, compute quantum corrections to them, check the algebra. If it works, you're happy. If it doesn't, you wonder why it doesn't work. Maybe there's a field definition that puts it in the right form. Maybe there is something else. The second option would be to compute something that's in some sense more physical and check the symmetries of that somewhat more physical thing, like the S matrix. I'm saying only somewhat more physical because the two-dimensional S matrix is not really physical by a long shot, but nevertheless, it's more physical. So one could attempt to construct the S matrix, perhaps perturbatively. One could attempt to check its symmetries, and then would remove some possible field redefinition, which are allowed in the Lagrangian, but would leave the S-matrix invariant, so one wouldn't really worry about them at all, but also opens the possibility of some other field redefinition, which one might not think about from a Lagrangian point of view. And as it turns out, this is what happens in this particular case. There are more advantages of this. Of this approach. Namely, it turns out that there is a unique S matrix that has the required quantum symmetry, according to these people. So one doesn't really need to check the symmetries, one just needs to attempt to match whatever one finds perturbatively against the perturbative expansion of what these guys say. And last but not least, it's a step towards solving the theory via Bethe-Ansatz. Okay, so I am going to skip through the three-level calculation because this has been done by other people, and the calculation is fairly standard. One takes the worldship action, this super coset, expands it around this particular solution and fixes Lipkin gauge, and then it's just standard perturbative three-level calculation. The S matrix does have structure following from the classical integrability, namely it's factorized following the manifest symmetry of the action, which is this in Lipkin gauge. And it doesn't have particle production. And this is something I wanted to show you, but I will skip. Symmetries and the assumption of assuming integrability and symmetries, one can write a general form for the S matrix. This is not the general form. This is the general form, general, because it doesn't assume anything. This is what follows from symmetries. Here, B, W, and V, and all the letters, they are functions of momenta, two-dimensional momenta and coupling constant. Some of them start with 1, some of them start at 1 loop. And you can see the ones that start with 1. This one starts proportional to the identity, so it starts with 1. These guys don't start with 1. There's one particular term in here, namely this one, which doesn't exist in the undeformed theory, which is parity odd. And it's entirely bosonic. This is something to keep track of. And the coefficient at three level is also very, very simple. It's just proportional to eta. Okay. So the three level was done by these guys. And it reproduces the three-level part of the known quantum deformed S matrix. So the goal would be to compute the one loop. One loop in the undeformed theory has a long history of lots of lacks of success. And eventually, there was some success not too long ago, at least via a Feynman diagram, via a Feynman diagram approach. Yeah, generalized unitarity approach to success was more or less fast, and the two, needless to say, agree. So we can use whatever approach we want, and you will not be surprised if I use generalized unitarity, I guess, because it's a lot easier. One doesn't really need to look at, for example, six field terms in the Lagrangian, or terms with fermions in the Lagrangian, and so on and so forth. So the strategy is simple. One makes an ansatz in terms of integrals, which happen in this case to be scalar integrals with slightly non-standard propagators, because the quadratic terms of this theory are slightly non-standard. An ansatz in terms of scalar integrals with free coefficients, and to get the free coefficients, one looks at what in this case are regular unitarity cuts in the S, U, and T channel, and then matches the coefficient. Each such cut picks out the coefficient of a single integral, and then it's matched against product of trees. And you can just read off what happens. This is what happens. The signs here have something to do with the statistics and the fact that these indices need to be rearranged from a standard form to actually end up fitting in this on these particular pictures. If one were to do this calculation in four dimensions, these coefficients would be functions of the loop momenta. In two dimensions, they aren't, which is good. It means that we can just compute integrals separately and assemble them later. And if we assemble them later, this is, and focus on the logarithmic terms, just because it's sufficient for the time being, this is what one finds. The one loop S matrix, and the index B here stands for bare, meaning that the asymptotic states of this S matrix are the three-level asymptotic states, looks like this. It has a piece which has a log and is proportional to the identity matrix, and it has another piece that's proportional to another log and also the three-level S matrix. Now, integrability and symmetries require another form. They don't require this, they require this form. This would be a rational term, and this would be the so-called dressing phase, and all the logs are supposed to sit only here. So there's a difference. There is this thing, which is a stick in the mud. But concluding that symmetries and or integrability are broken is a little bit premature, because the construction of the exact S matrix doesn't really assume that the asymptotic states are the same as the three-level asymptotic states. It assumes that there are some states, that there are some states which transform in a representation of PSU 2/2Q. So we can redefine the asymptotic states in a way that's not immediately obvious how to do in a Lagrangian. At least the redefinition that one needs to do is not obvious from a Lagrangian, because at three level, the asymptotic states are tensor products of single particle states, while the required ones are not, unless one is willing to assume that the spin is complex, two-dimensional spin is complex, and also introduce an auxiliary dimensionful parameter. Anyway, so I don't want to assume that. I am willing to break the tensor structure. And with that in hand, the redefined S matrix looks like this. All the part is proportional to the logs, and the three-level S matrix goes away. Everybody's happy. Integrability is back. All the symmetries are back. Everything matches. The tensor structure matches, and so on and so forth. The one thing that we didn't match, because it was too complicated, is the dressing phase. This is what we find for the dressing phase. These are three-level coefficients from the three-level S matrix. Now, what has been conjectured as the exact dressing phase is a rather complicated function, and expanding it is to this order is not obvious. But whether this one agrees with that or not, I don't really know. But certainly this one is the correct one, at least at this loop order. One can repeat all of this at two loops, and with exactly the same redefinition of states, namely this one. So this is an exponential here just to preserve unitarity. At one loop, of course, one is just the one and the first term in this expansion. So one can repeat all this at two loops, and all the log terms work out just fine. And this is what the S matrix gets matched onto. And again, the symmetries are back, and integrability is back, and so on. So I'm only 1 minute over time, according to that clock. So I'll stop here. And this is a summary of everything that I said, and some things that I haven't said. So let me not read that for you, but put up some questions. One of them has to do with the unusual kappa symmetry that I was mentioning in there, that I was mentioning earlier. So the kappa symmetry has a bosonic component. The question is it possible to redefine somehow the field such that that particular component is removed and everything becomes a lot more standard? If that were the case, then one should be able to one should have an easier time to read off fields from the sigma model. What happens to the singularity? What is the actual gauge theory? It's just saying that it's non-standard or weird is perhaps not exactly satisfying. Another question is, what's the meaning of the quantum group symmetry from the gauge theory side, regardless whether the gauge theory exists or not? It would be a gauge theory with the same field content as the n equals 4 super Young Mass theory, except that instead of superconformal symmetry, it would have quantum deformed superconformal symmetry. Your question earlier, what's the meaning of dimensions in this non-conformal theory? And last but not least, and related to one of the slides I haven't shown you yet, this is one complicated deformation of strings in ABS n cross Sn. Are there others? And I'm willing to bet that there are others. And what are they? Thank you.
So if you take your supergravity solution in the large rho regime, then as you said, rho becomes a time-like variable. So your solutions really look like a cosmology. There's an anisotropic cosmology with a Big Bang singularity, which expands out, mm-hmm. which makes it very interesting if there's a dual field theory description of that, because we don't have many examples of, you know, duals to real cosmologies. And,
No, and then it's vaguely desiderable.
Yeah,
it's
a
cosmos with
singularity, which goes to a desider type thing.
Desider type thing at
infinity.
Why
would
it go to a desider?
Wasn't your? I'm sorry.
No,
I was assuming you started with something that was vaguely anti-desider like.
So there was the desider did appear somewhere, but it was in the limit kappa to infinity.
Yeah, that was
that's, so for generic value of kappa.
So I got confused about the quantum group symmetry. So first of all, does the quantum group symmetry have actual U1 group subgroups contained in it?
Yeah.
Okay.
All right. Yeah, the U1s are all there. They correspond. The U1s in the quantum group are the Cartans of the original.
I see. And so in the classical space-time that you're talking about, you only see those U1 symmetries.
So it's, the quantum deformation enters in the commutation relations. So there is nothing that changes as far as the commutation of Cartans or Cartans with the other generators. But in the commutators of the one of the other generators, instead of Cartans, you get basically Q to the Cartan. Well, some combination of Q to the Cartan.
Mm-hmm. So I'm confused about which one's the where. You asked the question about dimensions. I take it that the there's nothing like a dilation generator in the Cartan.
No, the dilatation operator is not one of the Cartan generators. No, it's another one. It's some off-diagonal entry, which, well, it used to be the generator that sits in the, I think, in the two time-like directions of SO 2,4. So, yeah. This generator does exist in the deformed, in the quantum group. It's just that it doesn't necessarily mean the same thing. And since we don't exactly know the gauge theory, it's difficult to check whether it actually dilates anything in the normal sense. It becomes the usual dilatation operator as eta is removed, but that's all that one can say.
Any more questions? All right, let's go.